This hour's top stories, Iran says it does not recognize a ruling by a Belgian court against an Iranian diplomat, deploring it as a clear violation of international law. Tensions rise between Turkey and the U.S. after Ankara accused Washington of orchestrating a 2016 coup attempt. Also in the headlines, the Palestinian Prime Minister condemns Israel for demolishing a Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank. Welcome to the World News. Iran says a Thursday Belgian ruling against an Iranian diplomat is illegal. A foreign ministry spokesman says that Tehran will not recognize a ruling.
All the steps taken by the Belgian court and everything which has been done up until now regarding Mr. Assad's case, including his arrest in Germany, his fight, his clear diplomatic immunity, his incarceration, and also further on prosecution and the judicial process, and unfortunately this recent sentencing and judgment are all illegal and in clear violation of international law, especially as you said, the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations and Immunity. Therefore, clearly Iran not only does not recognize this sentence and this judgment, but also strongly condemn and deplores the decision by the court. Definitely Iran would reserve all the rights to take the possible legal and diplomatic means to defend Mr. Assad's right, and of course provide grounds for him to exercise his right. And Iran will not let this to intervene in diplomatic missions abroad. Iran will hold responsible governments that have breached international obligations, their internal obligations, and would strongly believe that such disregard of international law will set a dangerous precedent, which would ultimately would undermine international norms and would pose a very serious blow to the diplomacy as an institution, which is very vital for the international interaction. You have to also know in your audience that these allegations have been all fabricated, false flags, and a clear attempt from day one to steering the case in predetermined direction. Of course, it was plotted by the MEP, Mujahideen Khalq, and they have provided a lot of poisonous atmosphere that unfortunately some of the European capitals were tracking.
A court in the Belgian city of Antwerp handed down a 20-year jail term to Iranian diplomat Asadullah Asadi and accused him of plotting to bomb a meeting of the Mujahideen Khalq organization in France. In June of 2018, Iran has repeatedly dismissed the allegation as a false flag stunt by the MKO. That's a group Tehran deems as a terrorist organization. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, the MKO has conducted many assassinations and bombings, targeting officials and civilians there. The European Union's foreign policy chief says it's time to move from maximum pressure to maximum diplomacy with regard to Iran. Josep Borrell said the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal prevented the agreement from reaching its full potential. He said he is in contact with all the signatories to the accord to salvage it. The top EU diplomat welcomed the new U.S. administration's indication of a new approach on Iran. He stressed all participants are ready to engage. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron has called for expansion of talks with Iran beyond its nuclear program.
But I do believe that we do need to finalize indeed a new negotiation with Iran, and President Biden has a critical role. First, because they are much closer to the access to the nuclear bomb now than they were before the signature of JCPOA in July 15. Second, because we have to address as well the ballistic missiles issues, and we have to address the stability of the region. And this comprehensive agenda is to be negotiated now, because this is the right timing. And we have to find a way to involve in this discussion Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Iran has time and again rejected calls for changes to the 2015 nuclear deal and its original participants. Tehran says it's an international agreement that has been endorsed by the UN Security Council and is by no means renegotiable. The U.S. withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran rolled back some of its commitments. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he will return to the agreement, but only after Iran returns to full compliance. Tehran, however, says Washington must act first by removing all the sanctions. The United States says it had no involvement in a 2016 attempted coup in Turkey. The State Department described as wholly false the recent accusations by Turkish officials. It said the unfounded claims are inconsistent with Turkey's status as a NATO ally and partner of the U.S. On Thursday, the Turkish Interior Minister said the U.S. had managed the coup attempt while Gulen's network carried it out. Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish opposition figure based in the United States. Ankara has long accused him of being behind the 2016 putsch, something that Gulen himself has strongly denied. More than 250 people were killed in that failed attempt. Well, to discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in His Excellency Ambassador Uluce Uzulker. He's a former Turkish senior diplomat who joins us via Skype out of the city of Istanbul. Thank you very much, Beyefendi, for joining our broadcast. I really like to get your opinion on that development as well. You know, it's been 5 years since the coup. Right now, that report by the Turkish ministry is out, and the U.S. denies it. How do you see it?
Well, I think that there is a big contradiction in what the United States officials say, because Gulen in 1999 was taken back to United States for sanitary reasons and for a checkup, and he never returned to Turkey anymore after that. And secondly, there is another point which needs more clarification in Turkey. Gulen is not a person capable of organizing such a coup, an uprising from the army side, which had been prepared in advance since years by introducing to the governmental level all kinds of supporters from his side and trying to get over in Turkey the administration and afterwards with a coup, trying to get power in the Turkish state as well. This gentleman is still living in Philadelphia in a luxurious environment with a lot of support from the United States side. If there is any need for any further clarification, it's very simple. In Turkey, there are many findings from our side that Mr. Gulen was involved directly, but through the assistance of the United States CIA personnel. And if this is not true, then let's simply send back Mr. Gulen, whom the Turkey is willing to see back for a trial in Ankara, and this offer is always refused by the United States side. And we are asking the United States to go ahead with this trial in Washington, if need be, or in Philadelphia, whatever. They are refusing that as well. So one of the headaches between Turkey in our relations with the United States, Gulen is probably number one, or if not, he's number two. So why then the United States is not willing to return this man to Turkey so that the truth behind this coup can be established perfectly well? They're refusing because they all know that once he's back, the involvement of the United States in that respect will come on the surface, and that there will be no possibility to deny afterwards. So the simplest way to solve the problem is to send him back. why they don't do it then. I need an explanation from my side, from the United States officials.
Okay, Ambassador Uluç Uzulkar, former Turkish senior diplomat out of Istanbul. Çok teşekkür ediyorum, beyefendi. Thank you very much for your time
and for your
input. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh has slammed Israel for demolishing a Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank.
This settler colonial phenomenon, we have seen it, replacing people by people, replacing indigenous people with settlers. The Palestinians have been here for thousands of years. This land is our land. We are here to protect it. We have been cultivating it. We have been.
Shtayyeh said the Israeli demolition is part of ongoing measures in breach of international law and humanitarian treaties. The EU representative to the Palestinian territories also urged Israel to respect international law. The two officials were speaking after they visited the demolished Palestinian village. Israeli forces accompanied by bulldozers destroyed homes of some 60 Palestinian Bedouins on Wednesday. Israel claimed the homes were illegal. An Israeli rights group said the demolition left 61 people homeless, over half of them children. The Israeli army says an unarmed Palestinian man has been shot dead in the occupied West Bank. The army said the Palestinian had tried to infiltrate a home after entering a West Bank settlement outpost. Israeli army said the home belonged to a worker who was attacked by the Palestinian. It said the two struggled, and a third person shot and killed the Palestinian. No other injuries have been reported. Palestinian media say the slain man was from a village west of the West Bank city of Ramallah. They reported the head of the village as saying that the Israeli forces had seized the body of the man. Well, as the world marks Cancer Day, cancer patients on the Gaza Strip are struggling with grave dangers. Gaza's hospitals cannot provide the patients with adequate diagnosis and treatment amid chronic shortages of medicines due to the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon now reports.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate. Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The U.S. president has outlined his foreign policy agenda. Joe Biden has promised to engage with Washington's allies and confront America's rivals, but he did not cover all the major issues he's expected to clarify his position on. We have a report.
In his first major foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden has laid out his administration's strategies. He opened his remarks by declaring that America is back. During his wide-ranging speech, Biden took sideswipes at his predecessor Donald Trump as he gave repeated assurances that Washington will strengthen diplomatic ties with its allies to confront what he called rising authoritarianism by the U.S. adversaries, including Russia and China.
We will not hesitate to raise the cost on Russia and defend our vital interests and our people. And we will be more effective in dealing with Russia when we work in coalition and coordination with other like-minded partners.
The president called for the immediate and unconditional release of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, who's sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for violating his terms of parole. Continuing with China, Biden referred to the Asian country as the U.S. most serious competitor. He vowed to take a tougher stance against the country, including taking moves to confront what he called Beijing's economic abuses. Elsewhere in his speech, the U.S. president called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen, declaring a halt to Washington's support for the devastating 6-year-long conflict.
This war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution in Yemen and will make sure that humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. He, however, added that his administration will continue to support Riyadh and help the Arab Kingdom to defend itself. Biden later called on Myanmar's military junta that staged a coup and detained the country's civilian leaders over alleged election fraud this week to relinquish power, warning them of consequences. He further referred to measures he has already taken to reverse the previous administration's policies, including the re-engagement with the World Health Organization on the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. return to the 2016 Paris Climate Accord, lifting the so-called Muslim ban, increasing the cap on asylum seekers to 125,000, and halting U.S. troops withdrawal from Germany. Absent from his foreign policy speech, however, was mentioning of the U.S. stance of Iran and how Washington will proceed with regard to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He had previously pledged to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, but several cabinet members later said there was a long way before the U.S. could return to the international accord, which Trump withdrew from. Biden, like his predecessor, seeks to overturn policies implemented during the previous administration. How far-reaching those changes are going to be and how lasting and practical their effects would be is anybody's guess at this point.
A U.S. warship has sailed near a group of Chinese-controlled islands in the disputed South China Sea. The U.S. says its ship sailed near Paracel Islands in the Freedom of Navigation operation. On Thursday, the same ship sailed through the Strait of Taiwan to conduct what the U.S. called a routine transit to that drew a strong reaction from China. The military said the U.S. is deliberately creating tensions. China sees as provocation the U.S. military's presence in areas it controls. The U.S. has increased its presence in the past months and also boosted support to Taiwan. China sees the island as part of its territory and says the U.S. is interfering in its internal affairs.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
It survived its 40th to celebrate a 42nd anniversary. That's Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979, commemorating its 10-day dawn beginning 31st January in 2021. It begins with the return date of the first leader of the revolution, the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, all those decades ago. And it ends with the revolution. The day called Islamic Revolution's Victory Day, or 22nd of Bahman. That traditionally falls to the 11th of February. It's not the first time we cover the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, but this year our angle is how the revolution has survived over four decades riddled with hostility. Is the secret in some sort of natural resistance it has, or survival skills? Perhaps a little of both. For answers, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. Resilience is almost an undeniable attribute of the revolution, looking at its 40th. That was in 2019, when the country faced renewed hostility by America's Trump administration and their attempt at regime change in Iran, to put it in American terms. Our guest tells us what he sees as the key to the revolution's resilience or endurance. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is himself a veteran of the revolution, with an honest look to the pros and cons of all ups and downs that have ensued since 1979.
First, one of the principles of Iran's Islamic Revolution, which has allowed it to remain a dynamic and developmental movement, is the fact that it's based on people's votes. Our revolution has been a people's revolution, and it's this support that has sustained it and made it resistant to threats and sanctions. The next point was the leadership of the revolution itself. People looked at Imam Khomeini and saw in him all the qualities of a charismatic, popular leader and a religious man. They saw a politician and trusted him. This is people's trust in the leadership. This made the people willing to send their youth to the battlefields when the revolution was in danger, such as during the Iraq-Iran war.
You say Iran's ruling system hasn't yet fully evolved. That could be good. In what direction should it evolve in order to continue its survival with the satisfaction of the people?
Over the past 42 years, we have had costly experiences, victories, defeats, ups and downs. All these experiences must be gathered to be used for reforming the structures and laws in the system and even the constitution. That is, where we see a legal vacuum, we must correct it and move forward. If we make a problematic law, we should set it aside and make more progressive laws. If we have made mistakes that have caused us to deviate from the main path, God forbid, or there have been weaknesses there, we must make up for it. By preserving the principles and ideals of the revolution and its main slogans, we must improve and address the situations day by day.
This nation has managed to establish a system of Islamic Republic and an independent system of government. That is, a government not beholden to America, but dependent on national support. You may wonder about that, looking at Iran's anti-government riots bubbling and subsiding since 2017. But over 40 years ago, Ruhollah Khomeini's slogans appealed to the people's sense of pride and independence in the face of Western imperialism and socialist revolutions. Actually, this appeal has been a lasting one, and a cause of the revolution enduring all ups and downs, according to Mr. Taraki.
One important factor that has been able to increase this resilience is looking at one's own internal capacities and capabilities and not relying on the outside and not being dependent on the external powers. Other factor is the young human capital and Muslims and believers who have been supporting the revolution, protecting it against the enemies during crises, wars, and other challenges by showing stability and resistance.
Imam Khomeini's slogans of liberation from Western imperialism and socialist revolutions shored up Iranian resistance to America. And it didn't stop there, but went on to inspire anti-Western movements across oppressed developing countries. There have been protests in Iran from time to time over economic woes created by different administrations' shortcomings and mismanagement. But Iranians are aware of the role U.S. sanctions have played in diminishing their food and medical baskets. Also, the people are aware that if there's room for criticism at home, a foreign power certainly can't be trusted with their best interests. In other words, in the face of a foreign adversary, Iranians tend to stick together. More than that, Iran is a survivor, not of 40 years of adversity, but of thousands of years of foreign tribes breaching its borders or trying to. So even the unpolitical, if there are such Iranians, do tend to join forces to pull away from foreign dependency in another way. In the face of sanctions and power threats, the Iranian nation and government alike tend to strive for industrial, technological, and military know-how to get their independence. They aspired to it before the revolution, and with 40 years gained, they have come a long way in achieving those aspirations. Today, it's dubbed resistance economy, which is to promote domestic production when sanctions block imports of goods and raw materials to the country. I asked why Iran had focused so closely on its missile industry for military independence at a time of sanctions and no imports of advanced weapons systems. Mr. Taraqi is a former MP now entrusted with sensitive administrative positions. He explains.
یکی از راه‌هایی که می‌تواند دشمن رو در دوردست در واقع زمین‌گیر بکنه و اجازه
One of the factors that can ground the enemy in the distance and prevents the invasion of our country is missiles. We have reached a level of technical capability that we can produce precision-guided missiles. This means we can target only the enemy's military forces where they are operating from and won't result in collateral damage to civilians. This military doctrine is the best and most humane. This prevents incidents like those in the Yemen war, where instead of targeting the Yemeni military, Saudi Arabia bombs schools and hospitals. This is a sign of weakness and lack of humane military doctrine.
As for Iran finding its means of survival in its own domestic economy, the country's non-oil trade's gross revenues have grown 83% in the previous couple of years. And in December, the central bank governor said the nation's financial system had grown by 1.3% from March to mid-September. It is small and medium-sized corporations that are driving the expansion of Iranian manufacturing. About 1,000 of them have created or reinstated 17,000 jobs. These businesses account for 92% of Iran's manufacturing enterprises and 45% of its industrial jobs. Iran's unemployment over the previous decade has increased to 9.5% from 12.3%. Many have lost their jobs due to COVID-19, at least temporarily, say domestics barred from entering others' homes. But the above-said industrial corporations have apparently helped overall national employment figures. Mr. Mansouri narrates the revolutionary line of events since 1979. Let's hear him out.
Our national production increased last year. This shows that the country's labor force has understood the situation and is working. Most foreign goods are produced domestically. Iranians are making products including automobile parts, home appliances, and meeting the needs that were previously had to be fulfilled through imports. Now, we're entering an era when we say we can be the manufacturers of those products.
How long that may last if foreign investors continue to keep away due to U.S. secondary sanctions for dealing with Iran, it's not easy to tell. But then, Iran has its Eastern and Latin American partners. We've come to that moment when it's time to take a look at what other media outlets have to say. So let's return indoors from the Revolution Documents Center here. Finally, a close-up of other media outlets, beginning with Ahlul Bayt. The Islamic Revolution's astounding endurance for 42 years. Why is it? The president says Islamic Revolution is a purely cultural revolution, and that's where he sees the secret, apparently. Congratulating the arrival of the 10-day Fajr celebration and the anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution, President Rouhani said the Islamic Revolution of Iran has been a movement based on culture, religion, ethics, and to perform religious and Islamic duties from the very beginning. Speaking on Tuesday, January the 26th, in the meeting of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution, Dr. Rouhani referred to the process of the victory of the Islamic Revolution from 16 years before the revolution and the beginning of the movement until 42 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and said, "It is a cultural and religious movement that has distinguished the Islamic Revolution of Iran from other revolutions in the world." Dr. Rouhani stated that in all stages of the beginning of the Islamic movement and the path taken until the victory of the revolution, the leadership of the movement was the responsibility of the late Imam Khomeini and the grand clerics and religious people who were at the forefront of the fight for the victory of the revolution. Mehr News has a question. Why is the West not after constructive ties with the Iranian revolution? For almost 42 years, Westerners have been claiming that the Iranian revolution is coming to its end every year. However, it is the liberal democracy that reached its end, especially after the U.S. post-election events. Today, the Islamic Revolution of Iran marks the 42nd anniversary of its victory, while a few years ago, John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, had claimed that the Iranian Revolution would not see its 40th anniversary. Like many Western politicians, John Bolton's words could have been used as propaganda at the time, but the point is why the West speaks so angrily about the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Basically, what is the secret of the Iranian Revolution that the Westerners keep imposing economic sanctions and cultural aggression and organizing plots, conspiracies, and disintegration scenarios against the Islamic Revolution? Have other revolutions been like this? The answer is no. The reason is clear. The Iranian Revolution was not supposed to stay within the borders due to its characteristics. Moving on to the national interest, which does point out where interest really lies, Biden team must understand Iran to build on nuclear deal. As the Biden administration pursues new negotiations with Iran, it should do so with a keen understanding of Iranian strategic decision-making and what spurs Iranian flexibility and obduracy. The key to any broader deal will be to find areas that address U.S. national security concerns that do not infringe on what Iranian officials regard as vital to their country's survival. Today, no one in the Iranian political spectrum entertains the idea of giving concessions on Iran's missile capabilities. Hossein Salami, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, summarized the consensus position in Iran on the missiles issue, stating, "Missiles are defensive assets and a key element of our deterrence power, and we can never accept to disarm ourselves of deterrence capabilities." That's it for the news segment, but please stay on for our own narrative. We've said quite a bit on the fight for independence and independence to win the fight. So let's dissect the concept of independence. To the revolution, it consists of two things. The first is rejection of the ideological supremacy of Western liberalism with its exploitative capitalism and Eastern socialism. Second is elimination of Western imperialistic influence within Iran and the Muslim world. To achieve the latter, Islamic ideological precepts were prioritized to redesign domestic governance and foreign relations.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution has advised us to become stronger. We cannot talk of independence without becoming strong. If we depend on the military powers of the world to protect ourselves, or on the economies of the countries that are our enemies, this no longer means independence.
In confronting domineering powers, the revolution's four decades have seen four periods of hostility, pragmatism, confrontation, and diplomacy. The first period, that's early hostility and confrontation, was from 1979 for a decade, when Iran managed to thwart existential threats posed by the Western and Arab-backed Iraqi attack on this country. General Qurbani of the Iranian Army's Aerospace Division shared with us real experiences related. We visited him at his shipshape organized headquarters, where manners followed a standard even with foot soldiers. You don't see that everywhere just because it's military.
We had an issue of the armed movements in the west of the country. They staged an armed uprising. Pave was being besieged. Shahid Kishvari, along with Shahid Shirudi and other pilots, made the first night flight and liberated Pave. We had some 30 martyrs while liberating and dealing with armed conflicts of Kurdistan. At the beginning of the Iraq war on Iran, pilots like Shahid Kishvari and Shirudi carried out search and kill operations. That is, they did it by themselves and did not take orders. They targeted an Iraqi tank they spotted by Cobra helicopters.
The period of pragmatism and flexibility was of the 1990s and early 2000s, when Iran attempted to court European powers and the US, but with little success. Let's not forget that even the pro-Western pre-revolution monarchy fell out of favor with the US and Britain when Iran nationalized its oil and subsequently tried to further raise its price.
Every new president who came to power in Iran thought his predecessor's policies couldn't solve the problems, so he chose another policy. But the truth of the matter is something else. As we speak, the chairman of the U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee says if Iran recognizes Israel, it wouldn't be a problem even if it wants to have a nuclear weapon. He said it plainly and explicitly.
The third period en route to independence was open confrontation against the West from 2006 to 2013. And the fourth period, that's a return to diplomacy, came in 2013. It was the Rouhani administration's policy of flexibility that gave way to the 2015 nuclear deal. But Donald Trump ditched the deal in May 2018, and economic nuclear-related UN sanctions relieved by the nuclear deal or JCPOA rushed back at Iran as US sanctions. We've established the revolution has a natural resistance or resilience due to its spiritual concept, but it owes its endurance to other factors too, namely Iranian survival skills and determination for survival. This determination is intensified every time the country is denied something. For some years now, Iran has been pursuing a look to east policy. For the first three decades after the revolution of 1979, it imported weapons systems, mostly from Russia, China, and North Korea. But now, it is producing most all the means it needs to independently secure its own and regional state safety and export to major countries. The Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s was inspiration enough, inspiration that led to aspiration that never stopped. And now Iran is making from battle tanks and submarines to sophisticated unmanned aerial vehicles and long-range ballistic missiles. Not to forget, for some 20 years or so, Iran has been making several planes and helicopters, such as Azarakhsh, Saiqe, and Sabah. Iran also possesses varied range national radar systems such as Bavar 373. The country realizes, however, the importance of maintenance, so Iran procures and produces the spare parts needed to maintain its legacy systems, including its fleet of US manufactured fighter jets purchased before 1979.
We have the fifth biggest helicopter fleet in the world. The maintenance and overhauling of our helicopters were one day done by the Americans. But all these years, our flight engineers, tech guys, and pilots carried out the maintenance. Only two or three countries have the technology to build night vision systems. But thanks to knowledge-based companies, the youth at the universities, flight engineers, and our brave pilots, night vision systems are being built domestically.
The country's military produce is just meant as a deterring force against America and allies. But the longer U.S. influence in the region continues, the more Iran asserts its involvement in regional matters. Iran propped up the axis of resistance comprising Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. And it was instrumental in defeating sporadically U.S.-backed terror groups such as Daesh. 2014 was a particularly noteworthy achievement.
The military doctrine of the Islamic Republic, of course, is to first increase the defense capabilities in such a way that no power can invade it. Second, to increase deterrence to such an extent that the enemy doesn't dare to threaten the Iranian nation. Third, to move its defense borders beyond its usual geographical borders and to fight the enemy in the distance so that the enemy cannot even get close to the borders of Iran.
Between 2015 and 2019, Iran annually spent 4-5% of its gross domestic product, GDP, on defense. That's $18 to $22 billion. Although Iran's defense figures tend to dwindle with every round of sanctions diminishing its budget, the country's defense spending in the 2020 budget is estimated to be $20.5 billion, even with the U.S.'s harshest ever sanctions weighing it down. Now, it's all very well talking of how many weapons and fleets one might have, but when and how they are used makes it all matter. Intelligence in discovering the weaknesses of the enemy decides the target to aim for. But not every war is a hardware war, a battle of swords.
One of the most important factors that can maintain and sustain any revolution is to know the enemy's plots, the methods that the enemy uses, and how to neutralize those. Both the leader of the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini during their leadership continuously informed the people of who the enemies were. They have identified the U.S. and Israel and their allies as the enemies. They comprise the system of domination that's working against the Islamic Revolution.
IRGC intelligence operations cover not only the Islamic Revolution and establishment, but also the geography within which can exist the possible threat for Iran. And it was as early as 2019 that they felt a serious intelligence threat looming. IRGC Chief General Salami said, "We are in an intelligence war with the U.S. and the enemies of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic establishment, and this means a combination of psychological and cyber operations, military movements, public diplomacy, and intimidation." What are the main objectives of Iran's foreign policy? The Iranian Revolution intended itself as a revolt against domestic dictatorship as well as the international world system, which the revolutionaries found unjust. Iran became an active member of the non-aligned movement under the Cold War, chanting "neither East nor West," a slogan which, in promoting independence from both Eastern and Western blocs, prioritized unity among the Muslim nations and eventually among all the oppressed people of the world. With the collapse of the Soviet Union and end of the Cold War, Iran's foreign policy became focused on resisting the U.S.'s unilateralism in world politics by making an unannounced alliance between developing countries.
The foreign policy of the Islamic Republic is based on religious and Islamic principles in the Constitution. In this foreign policy, defending the dignity of Islam is paramount. After that, there is the protection of national interests. Next is the defense of world's oppressed that's emphasized in foreign policy. The fourth point is opposition to arrogant and hegemonic policies in the world. This again lies in the same anti-arrogance principles of the Islamic Republic. In addition to all this is friendship with all countries, exchange and interaction with all countries of the world, except illegitimate and domineering countries such as Israel and the United States.
There goes another anniversary and another episode of our show. But we will be back next week and each week after, so do return to the box at the same times and don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
As Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام أثقل ما يوضع في الميزان يوم القيامة الصلاة على محمد وعلى أهل بيته.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The heaviest thing to be placed on the scales on the day of resurrection is the invocation of blessings on Muhammad and his household."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when talking about excellent and beautiful conversations which have taken place between the infallibles and their students or their companions or their fellow men and women in the communities and in the nation, we find a very interesting conversation in the historical books. Now, this golden conversation is between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this beautiful conversation, we find that there are many different things which Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace be upon him, talks about with Jabir al-Jufi in this very interesting conversation, which is full of these exemplary moral standards and beautiful ideals. Now, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir says to Jabir al-Jufi in this conversation is that there is no abasement, no humiliation like the abasement of greediness. Even though this is a very short statement, truly it is very profound. And it is these kind of golden conversations between the infallibles and their companions or their friends which have remained and have been preserved for thousands of years. In this beautiful statement of this conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir said, "The worst kind of abasement, the worst kind of humiliation, the worst kind of feeling and becoming low is when you are humiliated because of greediness." And is this not true, dear friends? When one is greedy, it seems like whatever you have is never enough. You always need more. and more and more, and it gets to a point eventually where you are willing to do everything and anything to attain that desire of greed. And so surely there is no abasement, there is no humiliation like the humiliation of greediness. Beautiful ethical standards put forth in this conversation between Jabir al-Jawfi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Now, when we talk about Shia identity, there was a companion of Imam alayhi salam by the name Jabir al-Ju'fi. Jabir al-Ju'fi, he was a companion of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. One day, he was talking to Imam and he was like, I want to know who is a Shia. Can you give me the characteristics, the identities of Shia? Imam alayhi salam then mentioned, Ya Jabir, yaktafi man ittakhadha at-tashayyu' an yaqula bihubbina ahli al-bayt. Is it sufficient for someone who claims to be a Shia to say that I love Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam? Is it sufficient? Then Imam alayhi salam made a statement. He said, Fa wallahi, I swear by God, Ma shi'atuna illa man ittaqa Allah. Indeed, our Shia are those who fear Allah. They have taqwa. Wa ata'ah, and he obeys Allah. Wa ma kanu yu'rafuna illa bitawadu'i wattakhashu'. Shia, our Shia are those who are known by humility and humbleness. These are our Shias. Wa ada'il amana. Our Shias are those who, when you trust them with something, they will be entrusted and they will keep the amana. Wa kathrati dhikrillah. They are known by remembering Allah a lot. Wasawmi, they are known by fasting a lot. Wasalati, they are known by praying a lot. Walbirri bilwalidain, and they are kind to their parents. Wattaahudi liljirani min alfuqara'i wa ahli almaskana walgharimin, and they are good to their neighbors. They help the neighbors who are poor, destitutes, and who needs help. Our Shias, they are known by their help. Wal aitam, they help those who are orphans. Wasidqil hadith, they speak that which is truth. Watilawatil Quran, they read Quran a lot. Wakafil alsuni anin nasi illa min khair, they don't talk about other people except that which is good.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.